The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Football Weekly today with special guests Mr. and Mrs. Controversy, and they've bought the kids. With triple Premier League controversy, Chelsea nicking goal off Cardiff, Spurs fan with a smoke bomb, Arsenal looking like they might win something. Continental controversy, Bundesliga, Blundersliga with the Phantom Tour scandal. France controversy as Evra goes rogue on French TV. And in Italy, controversy. Shockingly, they didn't actually have one. Your Football Weekly team picks their jaws up off the floor, checks to see we've each got the right ones, and rounds up the whole sorry mess. The continent, the Premier League, the Champions League, and your post listeners. It's all in this Football Weekly. Hi, everyone. Hi, Barry Glendening. Welcome back.
Thanks, hi.
Good. Where were you, Barry?
I wasn't anywhere. I just had some time
wasn't
off.
Wasn't anywhere.
Yeah.
In the ether.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, Philippe Auclair.
Oh, hello, Jimbo.
Bonjour.
Bonjour.
Bonjour. No cravat today.
No cravat. It's too hot in here.
Hey, like it is hot. Lumpur. It always is when you're here, friend. Hey, John Ashton.
Morning.
Nice guy, John. French Phil and the Baz. We're ready. Hey, this was quite a special weekend, wasn't it, for goals? Because you had everyone wooing and ahhing over those Arsenal goals, but then PSG. What was your favourite goal of the weekend, Philippe?
It was Wilshere's.
Really?
Mm.
Even
I was
though
there.
Ibra
I mean,
that Ibra.
That makes it even more special.
Right.
Well, I tend to prefer team goals to individual goals. And
really?
Yeah. And that was really, really quite wonderful. It's actually one of the few occasions I can remember being in a ground where they replayed the goal on the giant screen and everybody stood up and gasped in disbelief at what they thought. Yeah, we really saw that.
Yeah.
With the same expression that was on the faces of Norwich defenders.
Right.
I've never seen a reaction like that to a team scoring. They were all looking to each other. The Norwich guys saying, did this really happen? Surely it can't be the case.
That just happened. Canaries, deal with it.
I do love those team goals, like Philippe says. Do you remember when Argentina scored one famously?
I remember Esteban Cambiaso, the 48 move against Serbia.
Right. I had the dubious task of trying to describe that in a minute-by-minute report. I'm still recovering. It was horrendous.
This, I think, was better than the Argentina goal. The Argentina,
I disagree. I would have this third behind the Argentina goal and West Ham's Carlton Cole.
Oh, Carlton Cole, yeah, that was a thing of beauty.
Was that last season or the season before?
Season before that, I think. When Zola, Gianfranco Zola, was the coach at the time.
I'd go with the Zlatan, just because...
Not Cavani, because...
No, I love the Cavani as well. That was great as well. And if you haven't seen these, really, really, you need to Google them. Cavani's is just luscious, especially because he's so relaxed. It's so smooth. He just strolls past the Bastia back line and puts
the way
it from
he rolls
an impossible
the ball
angle.
With the studs, I mean, the way he rolls the balls with the studs so nonchalantly
gorgeous.
To go past the keeper.
Gorgeous. And yet Ibra, because that back heel volley round the defender into the net to open the scoring...
Mm-hmm.
was just ridiculous, mostly because I don't think many other footballers could do it without jumping off the ground first. He does it, basically. He does a back heel volley about 6 foot off the air without taking his other foot off the ground. It's all just taekwondo.
The ball is almost a shorter level when he does that.
Yeah,
it's
why would you
insane.
Do that? Only Zlatan.
Can I just give one a quick shout, you know, away from all the kind of really high technique kind of great goals we've seen in the top level this week, to Aaron Davies of Exeter, who in far less kind of technical style hammered one in from sort of 40 yards against Scunthorpe at the weekend. Well worth searching out.
Right, that's a proper goal.
Yeah,
an
absolutely.
English goal.
I'd proper like English to goal. Yeah. Give a shout out to Phil Bardsley for that one. He shinned into his own goal against Swansea.
Right, and how about we give a big shout out to Hoffenheim for their nets, which enabled us to have the non-goal of the season in the Bayer Hofgate. We'll hear about that a little bit later on. Perhaps, because right now, Arsenal, top of the table, and Philippe, you mentioned you were there at the Emirates.
Yes.
Of course, it was at this point last season that Arsenal lost 1-0 to the Canaries.
Correct, and they were eighth in the league, if I'm not mistaken.
What
and
a difference a year makes in football.
Oh, dear, you've never said a truer word. It was a strange game, though, because it finished 4-1, it could have finished 8-1 if John Ruddy hadn't made some quite superb saves, especially one low to his right to Olivier Giroud. But it could also have been perhaps 4-3, 4-4, I don't know, because Norwich had a period of domination in the game where, honestly, they completely stifled midfield and looked actually excellent. It was a very odd game, more a game of great goals than a great game of football, if you see what I mean. Because, I mean, all four of Arsenal goals were admirable in different fashions. But there is something going on in that team which is quite remarkable.
It's a different Arsenal, is it, Philippe?
Well, completely, yes. For starters, if you look back to last season, you will point out that they only lost one game since the end of March, so therefore they had a terrific end to the season. But the results they ground out last year were not due to splendid inventivity in the 30 yards and so forth. It was really about, grinding out results and nothing much else. And I can't remember last year a game in which I saw the Arsenal of yore, those quick, vengeable movements. Whereas this season, I can think already of quite a few. Mm. They seem to have found their fluency again, and it's partly down, of course, to Mesut Özil. But they started to play like that before Mesut Özil arrived, and it's due to Aaron Ramsey, to the fact that there is technical continuity and the fact that Giroud is showing people what he can do, which is an awful, awful lot.
Right, and Cazorla coming back into the team and starting in alongside Özil and... Super star.
Yeah.
Is there any worry when Walcott and Oxlade-Chamberlain come back into it that kind of disturbs the whole thing?
They're probably worried because they will wonder where they're going to play. You would imagine that Walcott will, be put on the right-hand side, but the way it's working at the moment, it's fantastic. Mm. But it depends, I have to say, also very much on one man whose absence actually changed the game. I'm talking about Mathieu Flamini.
I was just going to ask
when
about
he left
his
the pitch. I mean, it was a completely different story.
Yeah.
Suddenly, they had real problems in midfield to control the excellent Housen and Leroy Fer, who started to play extremely well through the middle. But Flamini has been absolutely terrific for them.
Do you think he's been as important as Ozil to them?
In a funny way, yes, absolutely.
What's the prognosis?
For
him, because he had to come off after he banged heads. Is he all right for... Is it Tuesday, the game against Borussia?
Against Borussia Dortmund. Yep. I mean, Wenger was really non-committal after the game. Said that he would have to be seen by the doctors. And obviously, they will follow medical advice.
Right.
But he had double vision when he left the pitch.
I bet the Norwich defenders did too.
Tete? No. Have you seen the size of Tete?
Right.
Have you talked to Tete? You don't do that. It's like Tete is the Norwegian Yaya Toure. You don't do that.
Right.
He just went, oh.
I thought he was speaking French for a second. But he essentially had a tete-a-tete with Tete. That's not mine. That's producer Ben. He just gets better and better. Now, Borussia Dortmund, I bet they're concerned about this Arsenal team they're facing. Let's dial up Controversies Raphael Honigstein.
Hello, James.
Hi. Good. How are you?
All right, how are you?
Good, yeah, very well. Excellent. All good. Plenty to talk about with you. Let's begin with Borussia Dortmund and their trip to the Emirates. Are they concerned about this Arsenal team and the level of fantasy football that they're currently bringing the world?
Yeah, of course they are. They would have watched the game, and Mesut Özil's performances have been widely and well received in Germany, and this is probably an Arsenal team playing the best football in many a year, so... Jurgen Klopp will know just how difficult it is, especially with their situation in the group where they've only got 3 points at the moment.
Right. Borussia Dortmund with a 1-0 win over Hannover at the weekend. Are they still firing on all cylinders, or have they lost a little bit of momentum of late?
Well, they lost a little bit of momentum because of injuries. They had a lot of people out over the last couple of weeks. Marco Reus couldn't play, Schein couldn't play. Well, the two of them came back, but you could see that they were just a little bit rusty. And Jurgen Klopp afterwards said, well... I don't want to disrespect Hannover, but this was probably the kind of training exercise that it needed to be fit for Tuesday. So Dortmund weren't convincing. They hardly created chances. But, with Schmelz and Hummels also coming back, they're in pretty decent shape. The big worry for them is that the holding midfield looks a little bit thin. They've got always one guy helping the back four, whether it's Bender or Kehl, and they've been injured, and Sahin has only just come back. So that's where they might struggle a little bit. Mkhitaryan might play there as well, and Ilkay Gundogan is still out. So they have problems. They're not quite the side that you saw in the spring where they went all the way to Wembley. But they've been overall looking good this season, so I'd still expect them to give Arsenal a really good game.
All right. All very, very interesting. Because the plenty of other stories in the Bundesliga this weekend. They're sitting 1 point behind Bayern alongside Bayer, who not so much Bayer Leverkusen as Bayer Munich at Hoffenheim this weekend.
Yeah. I mean, this is this will go down as one of the legendary goals or non-goals in the Bundesliga, of course. Stefan Kiesling with a header that went through the side netting into the goal. And when you see it the first time, you can't quite work out what happened because you can see it clearly going wide. But then the goalkeeper picks it up from his net. And some of the Leverkusen players are celebrating. And other Hoffenheim players are remonstrating because they have spotted that gap in the net. There's just one small piece of string that had to become loose. And somehow Kiesling managed just to get his ball to hit that very spot. So a truly bizarre moment. And of course, as ever, it kind of reinforces the debate about video technology, about fifth and sixth referees on the sidelines, on the goal lines. And now we're looking to FIFA because there is a chance insofar as there is a precedent in the Bundesliga for that. In 1994, Thomas Helmer scored a goal that wasn't a goal and the game was replayed. The problem is that German FA and the DFL are very wary of making such a decision again because FIFA doesn't look very kindly on that and gave him all sorts of trouble in the past for having these decisions. So they've already said that they will only make a decision in conjunction with FIFA, and the indications are that FIFA will just take the usual line of the referee's decision should be final. So at the moment, it doesn't look as if the game will be replayed. Leverkusen have very kindly offered to replay only the last 22 minutes of the game. I don't know if that's going to sway FIFA's people, and we'll have a decision in a week or so. But of course, it just reinforces the whole debate about goal line technology and referees on the goal lines, etc.
Absolutely. Okay, now a quick word on Schalke, who will be hosting Chelsea. A big blow to them as they lose Klaas-Jan Huntelaar this weekend.
Yeah, I mean, Huntelaar hasn't been playing all season, and then just when you thought he might be getting back into the swing of things, then he received another knock on his ankle on his knee in training. So he'll be out until the new year. It's a big blow for them because he's such a key player. They haven't really got that many strikers, so it looks as if Kevin Prince-Boateng might once again play as a number nine. He's played there very well, but he's also had injury problems. And they've also just lost Hugo as well in midfield with a cruciate ligament injury. So they're a little bit, I wouldn't say in a crisis, but there is a sense that perhaps Chelsea have got them at a very good moment. Schalke have won 3-2 at Braunschweig, but it was a very poor performance, and they themselves weren't quite sure how they won the game. So I'd make Chelsea actually favourites to win their game in Gelsenkirchen.
Phil Honigstein live from the naughty step there. 4-1 Chelsea's win against Cardiff. And that, hey, we mentioned controversy. What on earth was the referee thinking? Barry, in case there's any listeners who haven't seen this, could you just describe it to them?
The Cardiff City goalkeeper, David Marshall, had the ball in his hands. He went to bounce it before kicking it out. And
but surely,
as he
Barry,
bounced it,
as soon as the ball left his hands, it's fair game.
You would think so, James. But apparently not, because when Samuel Eto'o poked it away and Eden Hazard went on to score, even though the referee allowed the goal, it soon emerged that according to FIFA law, I think 14, that the goal should not have been allowed because the ball was deemed to be still in the control of the goalkeeper.
While a goalkeeper is bouncing the ball, the ball is still in his possession.
Yeah, now I would imagine if, say, he was coming out for a cross and palm the ball down, then that would not be considered to be in his control. But right. I'm only hypothesising here because I haven't checked.
Well, it's health and safety gone mad, isn't it?
Yes, indeed.
You're allowed to pounce in when the ball is dropped by the keeper. In that particular case, David Marshall never dropped the ball. He bounced it.
There's precedents in the past, or similar incidents, where Nottingham Forest scored a goal where Gary Crosby headed... The goalkeeper was holding the ball on the palm of his hand, unaware that Nottingham Forest's Gary Crosby was behind him, and he slipped, nicked in and headed the ball and scored. George Best used to try and do it regularly, when goalkeepers were taking kickouts, they'd drop the ball onto their instep and he'd poke it away and try and score.
Did it to Gordon Banks once?
Mm. I don't know when this law was amended or if it has always been in place, but Chelsea's goal should not have been allowed, and it's quite surprising that the ref, Anthony Taylor, wasn't aware of that. Mm. And I suspect he won't be refereeing in the Premier League for the next week or two.
Right. Well, in the meantime, almost as controversial was David Luiz's part in Much's opening goal.
I don't know if it's called a controversy. I mean, it's actually three mistakes. There's Terry's mistake, Ramirez's mistake, and David Luiz's mistake.
Right.
And all of them compounded. Yeah, it was a little bit embarrassing, I must say. I mean, they still look... I mean, Cardiff made Chelsea look very, very, very fragile at the back again, which is a bit surprising. You would have expected... you would have expected a bit more solidity with Mr. Mourinho coming, but that doesn't seem to be necessarily the case.
Do you share Rafa's confidence for the Blues in their...
Yeah, I do. Shot? I mean, I do mostly, no, because also Chelsea, you know, showed far better football in the second half, and also because of the state of Schalke at the moment. You know, Braunschweig, beating Braunschweig, who are last in the Bundesliga in very unconvincing manner,
right,
is not exactly something that makes Schalke favourites, or not for that, absolutely not.
Mm. Moo, in the meantime, will presumably not be able to prowl the touchline in Chelsea's upcoming game against Man City.
Yeah. It's quite funny. A friend of mine texted me and said, guess who I'm sitting two rows away from? And it was, of course, Jose Mourinho.
Right.
After his little rant.
His little rant?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I thought, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Right. Good. I tell you what, it's been a busy part one, but that's enough of that. We'll be back with Spurs after this. The Spurs, with the 2-0 win at the Villa. Andros Townsend.
Well, I was just saying to someone yesterday that he must have sold his soul to the devil recently, because he can't put a foot wrong.
And he's got two of them, and he can use them.
Yeah, he certainly can. Certainly can. No, terrific stuff. And Spurs, in a game which some people thought they might have struggled in there away at Villa Park. But they bounced back from their West Ham disaster. And, of course, there's been much discussion about smoke bomb, which some idiot threw at a linesman. Personally, as a spectator, I do enjoy seeing coloured flares. I don't know why somebody thinks a big black cloud of smoke from a smoke bomb is a good idea, and even less why you want to throw it at somebody.
Yeah, but there does seem to be a lot more flares being set off or lit at Premier League games or English games. And while they do look nice and add to the gaiety of the occasion, they are, and, you know, we discuss health and safety gone mad, they are very dangerous. They're
pyrotechnics.
Incredibly hot. They can affect your breathing. And, you know, I just hate myself for even, you know, whinging about them. But, yeah, they're not a good thing, are they?
Right. That's a shame, because they look great.
Oh, they do look great.
At Wembley, yeah, for example, the Polish end just look fantastic. Anyway, we were talking about Spurs and other Premier League excitements. West Ham, great goal from Vaz Tay, but Man City, they bossed that one in the end, didn't they? Interesting tactic from Pellegrini, who apparently told his players that Man United had won, and even more extraordinarily, they believed him, against Southampton before they took the field, just to keep them, you know, revved up for the fixture. Right. We'll come on to that Man United game in a second or two. Of course, Man City have to travel to Moscow. They've got Cesca, who are not having the best of times. They've only got 1 point from their last five games. So
it's one win in seven or something like that. For
one win in seven.
Yeah, in all competitions, yes.
They were beaten by Zenit St. Petersburg at the weekend.
Look at the knowledge on Barry.
And only victory was against Victoria Pilsen.
Ooh, what have you got, John? Bring something to this party.
I've got nothing. I've turned up with a half-drunken can of Foster's or something, and that's all I've got.
Wow. I bet that's not true.
At this party of knowledge.
I bet you've got a little flask of Football League in your back pocket.
Well, I might have,
you're going to tip that into the punch later on.
Have an occasional sup from when nobody's noticing.
Right. Excellent. Huge surprise. A Stoke-West Brom ends goalless. There were goals, though, just for a change, in Newcastle's clash with Liverpool. John, did you enjoy that one?
It was a cracker. Mm. Yeah, it was a proper, in the whole kind of, in the fitting for the whole kind of history of that fixture.
Yeah.
It's been some crackers over the years. Not quite up there with the 4-3s and the 9-2s and what have you from 1909. But it was a great game. And kind of the sending off didn't ruin it for once.
Yeah. What about Newcastle then, who started off the day just above the relegation zone, but actually a similar distance from the top four? I think there were four off the top four and three off the relegation zone coming into the game. Are we any clearer on where their identity lies?
Well, not really. We know their fans are disgruntled. One faction of Newcastle fans had a pre-match protest, and I think the plan was to wave white handkerchiefs, Spanish supporter style, to show their dissatisfaction with Mike Ashley and his regime. And you can understand their frustration, but the team don't seem to be doing that badly. Alan Pardew was doing quite well, even though his relationship with Ashley is believed to have been completely broken down, and Ashley may want shut of him, but because Mike Ashley never speaks publicly and treats the club, you know, as his own personal fiefdom, as he's perfectly entitled to do as owner, we don't know what's going to happen there. I think getting rid of Pardew now would be a mistake, but it's difficult. Only time will tell what's going to happen in Newcastle. Their next game is against Sunderland in the league, and you would expect them to win that.
Right. But were you impressed by them as a team? Did they look like a team that completely lost its way, or one that was finding it out again?
Who, Newcastle?
Yeah.
Yeah, they were okay. I mean, in the end, they did pretty well to survive and hang on for the point. But up to the sending off, they looked pretty good. They look like, I don't think they're going to be in trouble. I don't think they're going to be sort of bottom three contenders this year. But I don't think they'll be troubling the top half either.
Well, let's talk about that Sunderland game coming up next weekend for Newcastle, because Gus Poyet beginning his reign as Black Cat manager at the weekend with the trip to Swansea, and the scope, the immensity of the task ahead of him, very much spelled out by that 4-0 scoreline.
Yeah, I mean, he said he'd put out what he thought was his best team, gave a recall to Phil Bardsley, the fullback, who had been sort of exiled to the naughty step by Paolo Di Canio, and people were talking. I think it's a measure of how much trouble Sunderland are in that people were discussing the return of Bardsley as if he was Cafu or someone, you know. And he proceeded to miss a very easy chance. I don't think it was quite as easy as some people were making out. It wasn't exactly an open goal or anything, and then he scored an own goal. But yeah, Sunderland are now, that's the worst start of any team in Premier League history. I think Portsmouth had the record before them.
Jonathan will be pleased, because he was very much hoping that Sunderland could make a real fist of setting a new low for a Premier League campaign. Yeah.
Well, one of my mates actually was saying to me that we haven't been half hard enough on Wilson for his prediction, you know, at the start of the season. That he tentatively expected Sunderland to be around 10th, possibly higher, in November. And my pal was going, you have to get stuck into him for that.
Wow.
He's been so spectacularly wrong. But I was in the same boat. I was very optimistic as well. But it's difficult to see how they're going to get out of this. They need more than a point a game just to get anywhere near sort of the 30-point mark or over the 30-point margin.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, well.
And goals of the weekend news from that match, there's Jonathan de Guzman's.
Wonderful strike, But Poyet seemed quite angry afterwards, and the manner in which his what he thought was his best side capitulated once they'd gone a goal behind was very, very worrying.
It was a timely win for Swansea, though, Philippe.
Yes, well,
their first one at home for ages and ages and ages.
Well, the difficult second album syndrome, I suppose. Right. And I think as well the fact that they're taking the Europa League extremely seriously, which is a good thing.
Who are they playing this Thursday?
Krasnodar.
Kuban Krasnodar. Aren't they that Russian side, Philippe?
Yes, they are, Jimbo.
Right. How was your second album, just while we're on the subject?
My second album was...
Was it difficult? It was a great album, obviously, but was it difficult for you personally to make? Did you feel the weight of expectations going into
the Not really, because there was no expectation whatsoever after the first.
Right. Okay. Hey, this breaking news, producer Ben, who got bored by that bit of the conversation, went off on the internet, has just discovered that Gibril Sissé plays for...
Kuban Krasnodar.
I must say my interest in Gibril Sissé's career and the Russian league has waned a little bit of late.
Really? I wonder what colour his hair is dyed now. I don't know what
strip. We will find out on Thursday.
Thursday?
Is he still the Lord of the Manor of Frodsham? Or did he give up that title when he presumably sold the Manor of Frodsham Unless he still owns it.
Yeah, maybe he still owns it.
Man United. He's still got it. Okay, producer Ben again got bored, looked it up. He's still got it. Okay, listeners, you've been waiting for it. Here it comes. Man United 1-1 Southampton. Hey, Man United have kept just two clean sheets in their last 11 Premier League games. Yikes. Was it an entirely deserved point, that, for Southampton? Lallana at the death?
It's difficult to know. I mean, Southampton have been very impressive, and you would have to be very churlish to say they didn't deserve that point. But it's also a game Manchester United could have won at a canter if they'd put away more of their chances.
I love the comment actually coming in from the manager to this game, where he said, "We're going to be confident but not complacent." But that was actually a Pochettino speaking about a trip to Old Trafford, which really gives you a little bit of a window onto how times have changed.
And how Southampton have progressed. I don't think it's the first time we've given some love to Southampton this year.
Right.
And the way they reacted late in the game was splendid. And they do have, I believe, the best pair of defensive midfielders in the country, in Wanyama and Schneiderlin, who still hasn't been called by Didier Deschamps, the national team. Banging
he's
the
got
same
a great
drum,
name.
But
if I was French manager, that would be the first name I'd say.
Morgan Schneiderlin?
Morgan. Is that how you pronounce it properly?
Yes, it's from Alsace, yes.
Right. Good stuff. France, eh? We'll talk about that Deschamps fellow and his French national team a little bit later on, because what we might do next is dial up Sid Lowe, because Man United in the Champions League, they're taking on Real Sociedad, and it'll be interesting to know Sid's thoughts, assuming he made it back okay from Luton, on that.
Hello, James. How you doing?
Hey, that's better, isn't it, listeners? That's Sid Lowe.
Do I sound rubbish? I better do.
Yeah, you sound cosy and comfortable, the way we like you.
Apparently it's completely different. The phone line does all sorts of funny stuff.
Yeah. This just in, man sounds different talking on telephone. Sid, here comes Barry.
Sid, are you aware that on the news billboard of the Broadway Hammond High, you're this week's star? Sid Lowe from Fortismere to Madrid.
Yeah, someone just sent a tweet not that long ago, and I've just seen it. I'm not sure I'd noticed it the first time, but Sean Ingle picked up on it, and so did Owen. So yes, I'm afraid so.
You have arrived.
Where is Fortismere?
It's the school I went to in
Oh, right, okay. Cool. A big shout out to the boys and girls at Fortismere, then. And indeed all North London school kids. Right.
You've just alienated all South London.
Yeah, kids. And East and West.
Well, to be fair, North London
school kids everywhere. Yeah. We salute you.
You are the future.
We are very much down with them.
Yeah, absolutely. But study hard
and just say no.
And you could get to Madrid as well, just like Sid Lowe did. Sid, what about Real Sociedad? They're yet to get a point from the Champions League. Are they about to change that against this shaky looking Man United?
Well. To be honest with you, I would imagine they're probably not. They beat weekend, which was really, really important, 2-1 victory at Valencia, because, as you rightly say, they've had a very shaky start, not just in the Champions League with those two defeats, but also in La Liga. And it's a real pity, because they were a great side to watch last year. I'm just going to have a quick look at the stats for you now. Yeah, they've only won twice all season in La Liga, and they're only halfway up the table. I was talking to David Zurutuza, one of their midfielders, a couple of weeks ago when they played at Rayo Vallecano. It was curious listening to him, because he seemed to be basically saying that it kind of doesn't matter, which I thought was really striking. At one point, I actually said to him, look, sorry for saying this, but it sounds to me like you either don't care or have already given up. And then, of course, he insisted, no, it's not that. It's just that we have to know that our priority isn't really the Champions League, it's La Liga, and that they are one of those clubs. But because they haven't been in Europe for 10 years, because in the meantime, of course, they've been down to Spain's second division and back up again, he said they're one of those clubs who don't look at the Europa League as a pain in the arse. They look at the Europa League as something that would be worthwhile if they were to finish third in the group.
Right, so they're actually aiming at third place.
Well, I don't think they're aiming at third place, but I think the point is that, you know, where a lot of clubs look at Europa League and think, oh, God, we didn't want this, I think they wouldn't see it as a bad thing. But, you know, if they were able to get a result, then they could turn it around. I think they've been a bit unlucky this year, but some of their fans are not too impressed with what they've seen. This weekend, the guy called Ruben Paradel, one of the central midfielders, played and scored a really nice goal, and I think there's been a real sense that he's the key and he should probably have played rather more.
Right, you're not big on their chances by the sound of it. Carlos Vela, could he pose a threat to that?
Well, of course he could, yeah, because he's a very good player. And this is one of the weird things about them. They're, They haven't been that good this year, but nor have they been that bad. And they have missed quite a lot of chances. Vela and Griezmann have missed key chances in key moments. I think they're a really nice side when they get it right. I think they've encountered teams that have been more defensive against them this year than last season. They've struggled in the sense that, I know this is stating the bleeding obvious, but not scoring the first goal has caused them real problems, because one of the things they did so well last year was carry the game to the opposition, get the first goal, and then pick them off on the break. And then, of course, once you can't do that, once you miss the chances that would give you that lead and the opportunity to go on and do that, they haven't been able to do that this year. And I think that's been a real problem. I think they look a little tired. And my personal theory, and it's no more than a theory, is that there was so much kind of emotional effort going into the fact that they would get through those two games against Olympique Lyon, by the way, in which they played brilliantly in both games, that it was almost as if there was a kind of a climb down after that feeling of saying, right, we're in the Champions League proper, and then kind of almost as if it kind of cost, it was difficult for them to then kind of restart, if you see what I mean.
Right. Do they travel well, Sid?
Well, I mean, last season they travelled extremely well. But, of course, so far this season they haven't.
Mm. All right. Sid, a lot of other things I want to talk to you about. There were two teams on 8 victories out of 8 coming into the weekend. They were, of course, Barcelona and Atletico Madrid. Both were gunning for Real Madrid's 9 consecutive win from the start of the season record. They both blew it, Sid.
Yeah, they did both blow it. It's a very strange one in a way. Barcelona dropped 2 points, and I know I've bored you with this before, but in the way the point system is in La Liga, the number of points that Madrid and Barcelona attempt to get, dropping 2 points is a really big deal. Mm. And yet they went clear at the top of the table because Atletico dropped 3 points. The big news, obviously, from that perspective is that Real Madrid won, and so now there's Barcelona on 25, Atletico Madrid on 24, Real Madrid on 22, and the Clásico next weekend, which means there's a good chance of Atletico Madrid going top, because I think there's a good chance of Real Madrid and Barcelona taking points off each other, and Atletico play Betis at home. But it was a surprise, and yet in a strange sort of way, it wasn't a huge surprise, in the sense that Barcelona didn't score in the league for the first time in 65 league games. I think it was a run of 64.
63, I've got here.
I think this is the 64th.
Okay.
So it was 63, but I must admit, I thought it was 64 and this is a 65th. But anyway, I'll double check that.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, obviously it's a huge surprise that they didn't score in Pamplona against Osasuna. They missed a couple of good chances. Cesc in particular, who's been very, very good this season, but wasn't great at the weekend. Messi came on late on and looked a bit kind of apathetic and wasn't that keen. But having said that, if you go through the fixtures and say, right, where might teams drop points? Away at Osasuna is usually one of those places. And equally, Atletico Madrid went away to Espanyol, who have a manager, Javier Aguirre, who does very similar things to Atletico Madrid. Atletico almost got out-Atletico'd by a team that were very tough, very defensive, and very good on the break. And they won it with an own goal from the goalkeeper. Cross came in and he kind of dived, I think expecting someone to reach it, and it bounced off his foot and into the back of the net. And so Atletico could count themselves unlucky, but they really didn't create much. Meanwhile, of course, Real Madrid won 2-0 at home against Malaga, with Gareth Bale going down for a penalty that was never a penalty.
Right. Wonder where he learned that from. He's been in the Premier League, isn't
Those
he?
Those cheating foreigners, eh? They come over here with their diving ways. And to be fair to Bale, I don't think he dived. I think he stumbled as he was trying to turn back. But one thing's for sure, it wasn't a penalty.
All right, I hope he didn't hurt himself in the process. Sid, let's talk about the big games coming up in the Champions League quickly. Barcelona are taking on Milan, and there's a fair chance that they will get back to scoring ways against the Rossoneri, given the way Milan are doing. Interesting to note.
Although they didn't last time they were there, of course.
That's true. And Balotelli was missing that time, and he's likely to be missing this time, but I'm not sure if Lightning's going to strike twice. Milan this year are even worse than they were last year. And the interesting thing, actually, well, you might not find it interesting, is that, you know, the ghost goal, the Bayer Leverkusen goal at Hoffenheim, which was part of a really shoddy performance by the referee who disallowed, mysteriously, for a completely erroneous offside, the opening goal from Hoffenheim, and then invented a penalty later on when he realised he'd blown
it. Yeah, it looked very much like he'd invented a penalty to make up for it, didn't it?
Well, he's refereeing Milan-Barcelona.
Yeah,
that'd be fun. Anyway, so I would think that Barcelona should be reasonably comfortable in that match. What about Real Madrid as they take on Juventus? Woo!
Yeah, potentially a really nice game this, and obviously the by far the best of the group. And Juventus are a team that everyone in Spain, I think, takes really quite seriously. Not least, of course, there's an awful lot of history there, because it's Juventus that Real Madrid beat to win the first European Cup for 32 years when Petr Mijatovic scored that goal. Of course, it's Juventus. That the Juventus side had Zinedine Zidane in it, who's now Real Madrid's assistant coach, and Ancelotti's been there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you see what happened to them yesterday and what your friend Giuseppe Rossi did?
I didn't see what happened to him yesterday. I did see that they'd been beaten. They hadn't played very well. And Rossi scored twice, is that right?
Three times. Yeah, three goals in the space of 4.5 minutes. From
really pleased for him, because he's certainly been through it, and he's I think he's a great player.
Yeah, well, I've got to talk a little bit because the listeners demand it. They're saying, I hope there's lots of Viola talk on the pod today. That's Pendragon and other people say, how good did Fiorentina look? And since saying that Juve didn't play very well, the funny thing was they actually looked great. I mean, this is a huge game. It was a big game for them because Roma had won on Friday night, and that was effectively putting Roma really clear at the top of the table. Juve needed to get a result. They were away against Fiorentina. For Fiorentina, this is the game of the season. And the atmosphere was electric. Lots of flares, lots of purple smoke. Fantastic kind of display from the curve of Fiesole with a big Fiorentina symbol and all sorts of messages about intimidating stuff. And they've been waiting 15 years to see Fiorentina beat Juve, the team they hate more than any other. All because of, well, lots of reasons, regional differences, the sale of Roberto Baggio to Juve, and also the time back in 1982 when Fiorentina thought they were going to win the title, but then, with the kind of last kick of the game on the last day of the season, Liam Brady scored a penalty.
Yeah,
that was always regarded as invented for the sake of giving Juve the title, as if that kind of thing would happen. I mean, really. Anyway, ironically, it was with a fairly dubious penalty that Juve opened the scoring. Carlos Tevez tumbling over and... Juve took a lead. By half-time, it was 2-0. They were really hitting fast on the break, Fiorentina, who were, you know, doing their share of the play, but just kept getting caught out on the break, and it was 2-0 half-time. And, you know, it looked like the lengthy wait was continuing. But then in the second half, they got a dubious penalty, which put them back in the game 2-1. And then there was this, what Antonio Conte called 10 minutes of madness, where they just lost the plot, and Fiorentina started hitting Juve on the break, and Buffon just looked slow and late to the balls. I hate to say it, and I know people have been keen to write him off because of his age before, and he's looked great afterwards, but in this game, he did not have the best of performances. And
Has he been poor in general, or was it just a bad day at the office?
In Confederations Cup. It's noticeable that all of the Juventus back line are not doing what they should be. We saw against... against Galatasaray, Bonucci not performing well, giving the ball away for Galatasaray's opener. And then the second goal, Chiellini, who's usually very reliable, getting outleaped by, getting beasted by Didier Drogba. And they're conceding goals this year. What looked like an absolutely rock-solid unit at the back, which the rest of the team was built on, hasn't been performing at all. And four goals in that second half from Fiorentina, as I say, three of them in 4.5 minutes.
Extraordinary. So yeah. It's Roma's Scudetto to lose, isn't it?
Well, they're now 5 points clear of Napoli and Juventus, and they have won their first eight games. It's only been done three times in the past. The team has always gone on to win
the title.
They've
only conceded one goal.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it?
It's ridiculous. I mean, one if you goal. Just look at the Serie A table, it's played 8, won 8, drew 0, lost 0, 4-22 against 1.
But all my Romanista friends, they say, no, we're not going to be champions.
Well, I think there's a lot of superstition about this.
Yes.
There's also recognition that perhaps squad-wise, they're not the deepest, and that maybe there's so many.
But they're not in Europe, are they? So
no, they're not.
It's a huge advantage.
No, although for example, we had some injuries on Friday in a game which Napoli could have completely changed had they taken their first half chances. But Napoli equally with Higuain out of the picture, and he is in the squad but in doubt for the game away to Marseille, which is a big game for them as well.
Very big one. Even though I would tell you in Marseille, most people are already resigned to the fact they will finish fourth in that group.
It would be great, wouldn't it, though, if we get to May and we have the sight of Totti wandering around the pitch with the Serie A trophy and then heading off to Brazil with Italy. Yeah. That'd be great.
Fantastic. In other fairy tale news, Lazio not so much. A lot of talk that Petkovic resigned on Sunday. They lost away to Atalanta, but apparently hasn't.
And is it true that Zenica Mihailovic has been...
I don't know, but that's who's been mentioned. Former Lazio player.
As manager of Lazio.
Yeah, he's managed successfully before down at Catania, who, by coincidence, actually fired their manager this weekend. Of course, Di Canio's free. You have a major Lazio connection there, but he does not get on in any way, shape or form with, and I know that sounds a surprise, but with the Lazio owner. And I think the major thing about Lazio is that they're very tight with their money, so they won't be firing Petkovic. But if he was to resign, that might happen. Anyway, Verona up in fourth, remarkable stuff. Newly promoted Verona up in fourth. Brilliant stuff from them. And Philippe, you're going to be telling us all about that after this. Okay, producer Ben has lost the edge, he says. But I think he's going to get it back because this is a pretty special final part coming up. It begins with the crazy times in Ligue 1.
Mm.
Right. Monaco are up there.
Yeah, because, you know, when you say two promoted teams in the top four, it's funny, but I was thinking, which ones?
Monaco.
Well, Monaco, yes, of course, Monaco promoted, but it doesn't feel like that, does it?
Mm.
So it's not exactly a surprise to see them there.
But Nantes?
Nantes, it's a huge surprise. So kudos to Michel Dazakarian, their manager, for taking this team that nobody, including myself, was giving any chance to, and getting some very decent results, and also taking advantage of the fact that some of the teams that you might have expected to be there haven't been firing on all cylinders.
Lyon, who've been rubbish.
Well, Lyon is a huge problem because, I mean, they were very, very lucky to get a draw against Bordeaux last night. It's a team in reconstruction, which is half a pun because the whole club seems to be now geared towards the opening of the stadium, of the new stadium, which is entirely financed, by the way, by the club itself.
Which is unusual in France because they're all
completely unusual and in fact unique. But it is an economic model which is very much that of Arsenal. That Jean-Michel Aulas is putting together in France, and he thinks it's the only way that any club will be able to compete with PSG and Monaco in the years to come. So I think he's resigned to the fact that Lyon is going to have a couple of difficult seasons of transition and then go back in the top three regularly from 2016 onwards.
Isn't it strange that Lyon's kind of current situation was almost because of the lack of competition they had in those years when they were winning all of the titles in a row.
Yes.
And they could have done with Monaco and PSG being around back then. It would have kicked things
off. It's true the competition was not as fierce as it is now. It's also true that it's basically the economy the economy bit back. And Jean-Michel Aulas was confronted with a situation, again, very much that of Arsene Wenger and Arsenal back in 2003, when they decided to go for the stadium and got planning permission. So what do we do? Do we accept the fact that we might not be competing for titles? We're not going to put as much money in the transfer market. We're putting the money in the stadium, which is what Arsenal did and which is what Lyon are doing at the moment. And, you know, it's going to be one big stadium. I think it's 58,000 capacity, which is a huge gamble in France to think you can fill that week in, week out in a city that is a football city, but not like a Marseille, for example.
Right. Well, meantime, Monaco drew with bottom of the table Sochaux, while Paris Saint-Germain go clear
atomized
at the top.
Bastia.
Atomized Bastia. Let's talk about the opening goal again. We did, yes. It was
special.
It was special.
We have got to say it was really special.
All right,
special.
So 4-0 in the end, that one.
Yeah, 4-0 in the end, and PSG starting to look like it's the first time they're actually top of the league.
Right.
Yeah.
This season.
Yeah, because they had a little bit of a stuttering start. Marseille had a superb start, as you remember. Also, Monaco did quite well until that draw in Sochaux, where I think they showed what is still lacking in that team, which is the fact that they've got, I would say, half a very, very good team, and perhaps four or five of the players who are with the superstars. Superstars, which, by the way, didn't necessarily perform. Falcao had a relatively poor game. And Sochaux, first game, by the way, in charge for Hervé Renard.
Yeah.
You might remember the man with the white shirt carrying the Zambian captain on that unforgettable night. Well, that's
last
him. It was his first name in charge. And he was 2-0 down at halftime, and he just said, lose 2-0, lose 4-0. What's the difference? Go for it, guys. They went for it, and Monaco paid the price. Well done, Sochaux.
Well done,
Sochaux. Who were last in the classification before that game.
A couple of other things I wanted to ask you about. One, Patrice Evra.
Yeah, well, that's a huge...
What happened?
Well, after the France-Finland game, he did an interview with a very popular TV program called Téléfoot, which is broadcast on Sunday mornings. So, and 10 minutes into the interview, for reasons that only he could explain, he started tearing into people. And I mean tearing.
What did he say?
I can't quote everything because some of it was edited out by Telefoot. I think otherwise they would have some serious problems. Some of the language was very, very crude, apparently. And he had a go at four people in particular. One of them is a journalist that nobody has heard of in this country, so can leave that aside, even though he made some rather disparaging comments about the physical appearance of that person. He had a good go at Roland Courbis, the former manager of Marseille, of course, who is a very famous pundit in France and who has, it must be said, has had some very severe words about every other player
right.
for a very long time.
He lashed out at his critics.
Out at his critics, but two of his critics, and that's where he went too far anyway in both cases, making also bad puns with the name of Roland Courbis, calling him Roland Tournevis, which is Roland Corkscrew. Roland Screwdriver.
Oh, Screwdriver.
Yeah. But then he started to have a go at Vicente Lizarazu, more or less saying, almost show me your medals, which is quite extraordinary. I exaggerate, but he said something like, I've been voted best left back in the world twice. Mm-hmm. I'm not aware that Lizarazu ever has. Things like that, which is, you know, extraordinary, really, to talk about perhaps the greatest left back in the history of the French game. And he also had a go at Luis Fernandez, who is also a pundit. And calling him Fernandel, which is the name of a famous comic, a bit like the Georges Formby of France.
Ooh.
And telling that Fernandez had done nothing but sucking lollipops and dancing the Macarena at the Parc des Princes when he was in charge there. So considering that Luis Fernandez is the only
true?
French manager, he did that, but he had very good reason
for
dancing.
He's
the only
game.
French manager to have won a European trophy with a
right.
French club.
No, I asked
and he's also a legend of the French game.
Right.
The and,
Lyon
he, and he
game
does that.
Bordeaux, they had a man on a unicycle going round a trampoline. I was just wondering if that was...
No, the thing is that, you know, there is obviously a big conflict there. There's a big problem of persons. And Patrice Evra has every right to think what he thinks of these people who have been very critical, sometimes hypercritical of him, beyond perhaps the what they should have said.
Well, they were criticizing his halftime team talk, is that right, in the game against Belarus?
Well, no. The halftime team talk in the game against Belarus was not what they had in mind. He's been criticized for years and years. Don't forget he was the captain of the team of 2010. He's the man, he was the driver of the bus of shame, so to speak.
Right.
And he's in a way representative of the disconnect which between the France and its national team, which is getting ever more serious.
I tell you what will help the French public's impression of footballers, the proposal for a strike next weekend.
Yeah, that's great, isn't it? You know, when you have basically latest polls about something like 75% who have a negative image of their team, you have Patrice Evra doing this on the day before the draw of the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
So we're playing on the 15th and 19th of November against who knows whom, because we still don't know at this time when we're recording this pod. This famous 75% tax on earnings above 1 million euros per year... this sea serpent, which goes up and down and in and out. Sea snake.
Yeah? What?
Well, why not sea serpent?
No, go on. I want to know what the sea serpent's doing.
That's what we call it in French. When you have a story that goes beneath the surface, then pops up again and so forth.
What would you call that in English?
Is that more like a Loch Ness monster type of
story?
Scenario, maybe,
that's what we call it in the journalism
business. A dolphin.
Right.
Yes.
I'm not sure that there's a story that's smouldering away.
That's why I used like the simile, which was borrowed from the French.
Right. I think it's
that's
great...
better than anything we've got.
We haven't got anything like that.
Okay. But to carry on, 75%, 1 million euros annual salary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So at one time we think it's going to be... it's unconstitutional, then it's constitutional.
But now it looks like it's back on the cards.
It's back on the cards,
perhaps. The man.
No.
I'm just
no.
trying to get to the gist.
Well... You know, it's so complicated, but basically...
Well, can I just give you a summary, and you'll tell me what I missed out. Okay, so basically, anybody who earns over a million is going to have to pay 75% tax, but it's actually the clubs who'll have to foot a lot of this bill because of the way the contracts are done. So a lot of French football clubs, not only PSG who can afford it, who have obviously got loads of millionaires, but also clubs like Lyon who are already struggling to finance a stadium, etc., will have to pay up something like 7 million extra, which they say they
Bordeaux,
can't
do. Their commercial partner, M6, the TV network, has indicated that should the tax Ajax proposal go through, they will think again about their involvement in French football.
Wow, well, that's interesting. And on all of this, while Monaco, of course, will just laugh happily down the Corniche or with because they don't have to pay any of these things, being under a different
For their foreign players.
For their foreign players, good point. And, so, the proposal is that in protest, French clubs might suspend activity next weekend.
Yeah, and go on strike. And that would go down extremely well, I can tell
you. Do you think
that'll
happen, Philippe?
I sincerely hope it doesn't, but given the state of things in my native country...
Would Monaco just go ahead and play anyway?
Yes, what difference would it make?
Right, brilliant.
It is an extraordinary idea.
Ah, especially for
And by the
French.
Way, they would go on strike for something which hasn't been yet passed into law.
Right, well, you know, prevention better than cure.
Philippe, is Patrice Evra's sort of... Well, I haven't heard it, but it sounds like it was quite the rant. Was that out of character for him, or... Is he a kind of a Roy Keane type?
Did you know he was on the air?
Of controversy.
He said that he knew he was on the air. It was recorded Tuesday, broadcast on Sunday. I think he was given a chance to correct and what he had said. I'm not 100% sure, but that's what I understood. And he stood by what he did. And as I said, Telefoot had to edit out some of the stuff that he said because it was just simply language that was. Unacceptable at such an early stage of proceedings on French television.
Brilliant, brilliant.
But he has a reputation, yes.
That's brilliant. I'm just going to quickly romp through a couple of posts. Yes, everyone, we were wrong about the Beatles when they recorded Abbey Road and apparently that business with the... with the level... Not level crossing, pedestrian crossing. I didn't say that's what happened. I just said that's what the story was. But all right. Mr. Trequartista says, in the Belgian game on Friday, the midfield Afro-axis of Fellaini and Witsel was pretty noticeable. Could you have an all-Afro 11? It's a good starting point, isn't it? Fellaini and Witsel. He adds in Dante, Asuakotu, Fellaini, Witsel, Huddleston and William. That's pretty good. Barry?
David James used to sport a fine Afro.
Very true. He could play in goal. Or René Higuita could.
Well, I would suggest that René, that's more... 70s Soul Glow.
You're right. David James is perfect.
Soul Glow.
Shed Exile has Carlos Valderrama. And asked if Jason Lee would count in Kevin Keegan. I think Kevin Keegan.
No, that's a bubble broom.
And that doesn't, it's not the same.
I have Gérard Janvier in France who could play in defence.
All right.
Even though it was more, it might be like the statistics, that kind of, Soul Glow.
No, it'd be like the Hair Bear Bunch.
You actually got a get it. What's his name? George Berry in there somewhere. I think he used to play for West Brom or Wolves.
All right.
He had a massive.
I want to see that team take on the Bald 11. Afro 11 v Bald 11.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, Bald 11's going to take it.
The Bald 11 every time, yeah.
So we've got so many goalkeepers. We've got Tim Howard, Pepe Reina, and all the other ones.
Fabian Barthez.
Thank you. And then loads of great players. Yap Stam at the back.
Would you have to be bald, or would you just have to
shaven? It could be shaven. Yeah. Skirtle would be playing. The big Czech, what was his name?
Jan Koller.
That's him. There's some great players. Of course, it'll be packed with Italians. That's what would happen. Actually, it'd be packed with Italians.
Would Paul Breitner, could he just go in the... It was very close to the Afro team in his pomp, wasn't it?
I don't know. Listens, anyway, that's something to talk about. You could probably have a whole league. You could have Centre Park,
Horst Rubesch,
Beardy. Anyway, there you go. That's enough posts now. Although, here, I do want to mention... Was this Shedek? No. I did want to mention whoever it was who posted in with the Space Monkey joke was a rubbish astronaut joke, and a much better astronaut story was the Good Luck Mr. Gorski story. Ben, have I got time to read it out? Basically... After, I was going to say Lance Armstrong, but of course it was Neil Armstrong. After Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon and said, one small step for me, one giant leap for mankind, all words to that effect. The radio conversation continued throughout his walk around. And the last thing he said before he got back on the lunar, the module, was, good luck, Mr. Gorski. And some people thought this was a reference to cosmonauts or nobody really knew what he was talking about. And he was always asked about it. Apparently, this is an absolute true story. He refused to reveal what Good Luck Mr. Gorski was about until late on, in 1995, a reporter brought this by then 26-year-old question up. And this time he finally explained because Mr. Gorski had finally died. So Neil felt he could answer the question. But It runs like this. When he was a kid, Neil Armstrong, he was playing baseball with a friend in his backyard. His friend hit a fly ball which landed in front of his neighbour's bedroom windows. His neighbours were Mr. and Mrs. Gorski. As the young Neil leant down to pick up the ball, he heard Mrs. Gorski shouting at Mr. Gorski, "Sex! You want sex? You'll get sex when the kid next door walks on the moon!"
I've heard that story before. It's a good one. But
it's a fantastic
story. I'm not sure if it's true.
I think that rounds it up then for what's been a fairly busy Football Weekly. We'll be back on Thursday with a reaction to the Champions League action that awaits. Where are you going to be, Philippe?
Arsenal Dortmund.
Ooh, right. Okay. I have a funny feeling that all the Premier League sides might win, actually, this week.
So do I, funnily enough.
Okay.
Strangely enough. Mm. Famous last words.
Well, indeed so. All right, then. And they're not the last words, though, because I'm now going to say goodbye. Thanks, producer Ben. Thanks, Barry Glendenning. Thanks, Philippe Beauclair. And thank you, John Ashdown, and you, listener. We'll be back on Thursday. Have a super week. Ta-ra.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code GUARDIAN.